Guess who's back? Back again. Rally's back. Tell a friend. Oh, wait. You're a wrestling fan. You have no friends, so. Just sing it really loud from your mom's basement. But yes, yes, I am back. Jim Valley has returned to Saturday Morning Wrestling. Thank you to Pat McNeil for filling in for me while I was enjoying the sun and fun of St. Lucia. 1 week ago, I was skidding across the sea in a catamaran, and today I'm back up in my house talking to you wrestling losers. Yeah, what's not to miss about St. Lucia? Anyway, we are back live from the Polyester Pleasure Palace on the shores of a beautiful Lake Washington, or as close as I can get in my price range, Jim Valley. Saturday Morning Wrestling here on the PW Torch live cast each and every Saturday, 8:30 Pacific, 11:30 on the East Coast of the United States. And you can also download us free at pwtorchlivecast.com. And it's good to be back. And we have got a show for you today. You know, even though this is a nostalgia show and we play on the heartstrings of your memories and your childhood, we do try to keep things current and do keep things active. So this past Monday, when I heard JBL mention Dusty Wolf in his commentary in passing, I went, we have got to make that happen. And sure enough, we have made that happen. On the show today, Dusty Wolf. If you grew up in the 80s or 90s, you're probably most familiar with him as a enhancement talent for WWE. Also did some stuff for WCW. He was even on Nitro at times and did Saturday Morning Wrestling on the Mothership, if you will. But Dusty Wolf is going to be on. And you know, I just read his book. He's got a book you can find on Amazon. And the thing about Dusty is he did a lot of stuff, not just, you know, enhancement guy stuff, not just putting over WWF superstars. He did a lot of stuff. He traveled all over the world. He wrestled in South Africa. He wrestled in India. He wrestled in Malaysia. He wrestled in Singapore. He wrestled all over the country. He did a ton of international tours. And we'll talk about all of the things that he did and all of the crazy places that he wrestled. And, you know, when you wrestle internationally, it opens you up to some crazy stuff. And he had some crazy times, particularly in India. He also was good friends with Bruiser Brody, also good friends with Dick Murdoch. He was also worked a lot in South Africa with Lance Von Erich. So we can talk about his thoughts about Lance Von Erich, the fake Von Erich brother. If you don't know, toward the dying days of World Class with the Von Erichs, what would happen is Fritz decided to take a wrestler by the name of Kevin Vaughn, who was a local Texas athlete who was fairly well known, and they claimed that he was a cousin, that he was the son of Waldo Von Erich, who was a kayfabe relative of Fritz. Well, obviously that didn't go over very well, and not only that, but paychecks started bouncing, and Kevin Vaughn decided to leave, and that's when Fritz went on TV and denounced him that he was never a Von Erich, and it was all a big fiasco. So we'll talk to Dusty Wolf about that. We'll talk to him what it was like to be in the WWF. I mean, he was in the WWF. While he never had an official contract, he was a regular enhancement guy for a long, long time, from the 80s all the way into the 90s. And, you know, he was there as part of the steroid and drug scandal while he wasn't a participant, but he was around. He can talk about that. So we're going to have a lot of things to talk about with Dusty Wolf, and you can call in and talk to Dusty at 646-721-9828, 646-721-9828. And that's the thing. You know, if it's going to be a big star, it's going to go on probably on Wade's show on Thursdays with the Interview Thursday. But, you know, we try to have some really good stories here. And while Dusty Wolf isn't the biggest name in the world, he does have some pretty good stories, and it gives you a good perspective about what it was like as an underneath guy. You can email at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. So we can talk about that and all these fun things as we move on with the Saturday Morning Wrestling here on the PW Torch Livecast. But Dusty Wolf coming up in just a little bit. So if you want to talk to Dusty or ask him questions. Hey, a couple of things about Dusty I do want to mention. He doesn't really watch the modern product today, so don't call and ask him who he likes or things like that. He's one of those guys, he walked away. And luckily for him, he walked away. He's now a college professor of history. So good for him that he's able to turn a positive, you know. That's the one thing, is if you do read his book, it's like he kept everything in perspective, and, you know, he knew when to get out, and, yeah, again, he found a good way to move on and move up, so that was good. So, hang on, I'm getting an email from Dusty. Yeah, sure, I guess he wants to even call in now. Sure, go ahead and call in now. There we go. All right, there's Dusty wants to call in, so I guess we're going to get Dusty a little bit early, which is fine. But anyway, I also want to talk about a little bit later on the Clash of the Champions. Looks like it's true, and WWF is bringing back Clash of the Champions. So we can talk about your favorite Clash moments and some things like that. But before we do that, let's go to the phone and go to 862. 862, you're on the live cast. It's Jim Valley back on Saturday Morning Wrestling. Who's this and where are you calling from?
Kyvan from North New Jersey.
What's going on?
Not much, Jim. How are you this week?
I'm doing fine. You know, we're back plugging away. You know, it's definitely a transition to go from St. Lucia to here, but we're making it happen. So what's on your mind, brother?
Not much, I was just going to bring up with you the restoration of Clash of the Champions and whether you think that is a good move or whether you believe WWE is trying to, for lack of nicer word, prostitute that name to, in some small way, denigrate or degrade the legacy of Dusty Rhodes to prove that they own wrestling history instead of other promotions.
You know, I think obviously they love Dusty. I think Dusty's time in NXT and help in that regard, and taking so much time to help some of the young guys, I think that really made him very popular with a lot of the wrestlers. And so, no, I think they really love Dusty. I think the fact that Dusty has a statue, and Dusty is not a WWF guy, he was a Crockett guy, and he was a guy that they competed against for the longest time. I think the fact that Dusty got a bronze WrestleMania statue before, say, Roddy Piper did, or who knows if Roddy Piper ever will. I think they love Dusty a lot. I think Dusty is part of the memory. I think he's almost like a modern-day Fred Blassie, where they love Dusty. You know, I think the other thing is that living in the network era, I don't think they're trying to do anything with it, because it's not like they can get ratings off of it or anything. No, I think it's a good thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. And as far as prostitution goes, it's wrestling. Everything is prostitution.
Good point.
Did you ever see many of the Clash of the Champions, Kylan? Did you just see the end of them, like the NWO? Oh, no, you got into it. How long have you been watching wrestling again?
Almost 14 years.
I don't know. You probably didn't see any of the Clash of the Champions live
I've seen all of them. I just didn't see them while they were actually happening.
Gotcha. So, in hindsight, were there any that you really liked?
One, three, and six mostly.
Sure, those were kind of the classic ones. I mean, the first one obviously had so much impact. You can't take away what a huge impact that had on the wrestling business that it had on WrestleMania and that it had on Sting's career and the legacy of Ric Flair and all of those things. But, I remember how exciting it was. I loved the Clash of Champions because you always knew something was going to happen. Sometimes they kind of sucked. Sometimes it just seemed like they were just angle alerts. But other times, the New York Knockout was awesome. The one with Terry Funk and Ric Flair. That was an awesome one.
That was seven. That was nine. That was good too. And the one with Ric Flair and Vader, which I think that was 25.
Trying to remember Ric Flair and Vader. Oh yeah. That's right. They had for the world title. I also remember some of my other favorite memories from Clash of the Champions. I remember Stan Hansen beating the hell out of Lex Luger. That was kind of weird. He just kind of came out of nowhere and beat up Luger. That was an interesting time. Was it on a Clash of Champions or was it a Nitro? Brian Pillman accosted Bobby Heenan and Bobby Heenan dropped the F-bomb on TV. Was that a Clash? Was that a Nitro?
That was Clash 20. Clash number 28, I believe.
That sounds right. Of course, then we also saw. I remember what a big deal the first encounter between Sting and the Black Scorpion. That was a big deal. It kind of turned out to be a bust, but before that whole Black Scorpion thing went haywire, that was a pretty awesome gimmick. That was pretty cool. So. But no, I think it's going to be a good thing. I think in the era of the WWE Network. I think, you know, why not do it? It's not like they're going to get great ratings. I mean, even Saturday Night's Main Event kind of lost its luster as far as ratings went in 06 and things like that when they tried to bring it back. So I think on the network it works perfectly. It's a nice nostalgia thing, and you can create new meaning. And you know, again, in the network era, things don't really matter. So, all right, Kyle, hey, man, I appreciate your phone call. Thanks so much for dialing in. At 646-721-9828, 646-721-9828.
When you're looking to tune in live to the PW Torch Livecast, find out about the next episode, or just catch up on an episode you missed, go to our new website, pwtorchlivecast.com. You can select shows by specific day, specific host, and format, including a grid of our latest interviews and best of selections on the homepage. That is pwtorchlivecast.com, where you can stream our show live and listen to past shows on demand. That's pwtorchlivecast.com. Do you shop at amazon.com? If so, do you know there's a way for you to support the PW Torch Livecast without doing anything different other than starting your shopping at pwtorch.com/amazon? When you go to pwtorch.com/Amazon, click on the Amazon link, and you land at the Amazon homepage. But anything you buy on that shopping trip, we get a commission for. It's a way to throw a few extra quarters, maybe a couple bucks in the tip jar, as a way to say thanks for what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast. So next time you're about to shop at Amazon, don't type in AMAZ. Stop right there and type in pwtorch.com/Amazon. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. A free, easy way to help support what we do here at the Livecast. Thank you.
And now, as we have promised, calling in from, I believe, in Texas, his home, a guy that was mentioned this week on Monday Night Raw by JBL, joining us now, a longtime wrestler, a guy who's been all over the world. We'll talk to him about all of his ventures. Dusty Wolf. Dusty, what's going on, man?
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good, dude. Good. Hey,
I'm
man,
just
I'm
living
really
the dream around
you.
Here, man.
I bet you are. Now, tell us, these days you're a high school, you're a college professor. You teach history now.
Yes, I got out. I retired. You know that old saying, we don't retire from the wrestling business, and I believed it for the longest time. But then when I realized how easy I've got it now, I don't look back. I say hello to some friends, and that's about it. Yeah.
You like the hours. You like being home with your family. You like the consistent paychecks. Yeah.
All of the above. Yes. But I wouldn't trade what I did for anything, but yeah, I love what I got going now.
Well, hey, man, congratulations on being one of the success stories and getting out when the getting was good and not being one of those tragedies, which we see far too many of. When I saw on Twitter, your wife responded to me on Twitter when I mentioned that JBL had mentioned you, and she had mentioned that you're teaching history. I was like, oh, my God, that's so great, because, like I said, there have been so many tragedies that you have probably known and seen and probably still see sometimes in Texas. But, no, man, that's great. Awesome.
Yeah, I just refused to be that guy. I can remember right before I decided I was retiring, I had no idea what to do because I was that guy. I had spent, at that time, 26, 27 years doing nothing but wrestling. And I knew it all revolved about going back to college. That part I knew. And then as I got to going, I ran into some good professors and realized this is what I enjoy as far as, you know, history and maybe teaching and, you know, that being in front of people never leaves you, even if you do retire or walk away. And so it just fell into place for me. So I'm kind of fortunate in that fact. It wasn't like I had to search and do all that like some guys have to and never find it.
So what's your favorite thing to teach about history?
Civil rights.
Nice.
Just straight up. That fascinates me.
Nice. Well, we're talking with Dusty Wolf. You may remember him from being an enhancement talent for WWF in the 80s and 90s. But I read your book, and, man, you were all over the world. You've been to God, how many different countries did you wrestle in?
22, 23, something like that. The way that I'm remembered is, I don't know if it's more a testament to, well, I do. It's more of a testament to just how strong Vince made the WWF the last 30-something years. Because I spent 29 years nonstop in the wrestling business, but people remember 6.
Right.
And when you say hit all the world, except for one trip, I probably left the country 26, 28 times on overseas tours. Only one of them was for Vince. The rest of them were on my own, so to speak. If I wasn't getting booked because of whatever reason, I was the booker.
So you've wrestled all around the world, all around the country. Tell me, do you find that wrestling crowds, or are they dramatically different?
They were wrestling crowds closer to a standard or a large group before the death of kayfabe. There were differences. Don't ever let anybody tell you they weren't, because you could go north and they enjoyed more wrestling. You go south, they enjoyed more brawling, more gimmicks. You go here in Texas, they just like big men beating each other up. But they still enjoyed the story, the gimmick, the angle, and their hour-and-a-half show within, like I say, their larger parameters, if that makes sense. After the death of kayfabe and the internet coming along and all the dirt sheets and whatever, there's completely different wrestling fans today. At least there were when I quit. I mean, it got to the point where you go to the biggest city on the East Coast, up north, that sort of thing. Even down here, but the bigger cities. And you would have the smart marks that just know they know everything. And you couldn't do anything for them if you tried, unless you had been seen on their computer screen as some kind of god or something. But then you go to the smaller towns, and they were just like walking back into the 80s and 90s.
When you talk about the death of kayfabe, just approximate it for me. What year do you think? What years are you talking about when you think that? When you first really noticed it?
Yeah, the early 90s.
Early
90s. We're the ones that lied to ourselves that the fans didn't know. The fans always knew. It's just that as long as we kept that kayfabe going, they were willing to suspend belief when they walked into a building. They really didn't. One thing that they didn't know was guys that were going to be finishing up. They didn't know that a guy was going to Japan for 8 weeks, and so he legitimately might be injured. And more importantly, they didn't know who that evil manager was going to bring in to try and destroy the champion. Yeah, those things, even if fans knew what was going on in the moment, they didn't know all that. Which, yeah. Don't anybody ever kid you, that helped sell tickets. And all that changed. It began to change with the dirt sheets, but it really changed. And the tipping point was the admission in front of the New Jersey State House that time. From that point forward, it just gradually became, by the mid-90s, it became to where even 10-year-olds could tell you who was finishing and who was coming in and who had signed and that sort of thing. And when they know that, there's just nothing left to sell.
We're talking with Dusty Wolf. We got an email question here from Brian. From Phoenix. He's a 25-year PW Torch VIP subscriber. He wants to know, he said, Dusty, I always enjoyed your work. My question is, during those marathon 1980s WWF TV tapings, what was the most number of matches you had in one day?
Four. Quite often I had two. I can remember having four.
Do you remember who they were, who your opponents were?
Oh, Lord, no. no, there's no way. Because I did this here a couple of years ago just out on a lark. I tried to figure out pretty close to how many matches I had in my career, and it had to be over 4,000. So, with nights like that where you're working two, sometimes three or four times a night, it just adds up. You just completely forget.
Now, do you remember if you were you scheduled for four matches, or did it just work out? Maybe somebody wasn't
never,
there and you had to pull?
Usually you were scheduled for one, in my case, because they loved me so much. You knew there was two, tape two and then a dark, or tape one and tape three. That's where you knew that. But when it started to get into three and four, that was because somebody didn't show up, somebody got hurt. The one match was so bad, Vince says, go film it again. So all of a sudden you're inserted into it, that sort of thing.
He also wants to know, were you required to help getting the arena ready, like setting up ring chairs or anything like that? No.
No. That the referees were responsible for the ring. And in a building that size, they have staff. The whole idea of the crew setting, the wrestling crew setting up a building started with the wrestling schools, with promoters that like to promote. And I understand they have to, but some, not all do, but promote on the cheap. And if you've got that school, there's no more dues to pay the old way. You got to pay somehow. Vince, how would that look if you had, I don't know who some of the top guys are anymore, Steen or the Usos, if they're still there. How would that look if you had fans filling into the building and these guys are setting up chairs?
Now, it's my understanding, there's a famous story in Dynamite Kid's book that the guys who were under WWF contract, they got about $25 to do TV. But guys
50.
In your position, $50. You got paid. You got paid more, didn't you? Didn't you get your? Didn't you get?
I came in under a TV deal, and for some reason, it never changed. Even when I went full time, and I honestly never said anything. I let it stay. I knew I was there for a much shorter time than most of those guys, so I was going to get everything I could. I'm not going to lie, because there was no reason for me to be there in the first place. I was just fortunate enough to end up there somehow. But, the guys that had their deal, they would get $50 a day for TV, but that's the old-style theory of this is your commercial time to shine. If you can get over, you'll make more in the next few weeks than we could ever pay you at this TV. Like in Memphis, if you were in the crew, you didn't get paid for TV. You'd be there Saturday morning bright and early, but you didn't get paid for TV if you were in the crew. I know that for a fact. San Antonio, you get $25 for TV. A couple other places were just like that. The TV payday was absolutely horrible because it was your commercial. It was your time to shine, get over or not.
But you were treated differently because of your deal.
Yeah, because I had a deal. Vince had to have that kind of deal in those days to have guys to get his people over, because he can't have superstars. That's part of my problem. That's part of the reason I quit watching the show. You can't have superstars if they're continually just beating each other. You have to have someone that gets these guys over, and it doesn't make us look good. It doesn't make us look competitive. It doesn't make us look like some kind of great athlete, but it's a job. And in order to entice that, you do have to pay a little bit better, especially considering that a lot of those guys, the only time they saw the WWF ring was that one time a year that they came to that area. So it was a whole different world. The dynamic and the mentality that created it is completely gone.
Let's go to a phone call. We got a question for Dusty Wolf. 814-814, yes. You're on the line. Who's this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Hey, Ryan, what's going on? What do you got for Dusty?
My question for Dusty is, when you wrestled the barber Brutus Beefcake, did you get more money when he chopped your hair off?
Yeah, that was part of it. Whenever they would do something that could be considered humiliating like that, they would take care of the guys. I couldn't tell you how much anymore, but I know there was always, yeah, things like that, or I guess that was the main one. But there was always a little something that there was extra payday here and there because they knew it was kind of humiliating.
What about like the snake or anything with Jake Roberts?
The snake itself, no, because that was just part of it. No.
Sure.
I can't remember ever being anything extra with the snake. I remember the body bag in the beginning was. I don't know how that, I don't know if that lasted or not. It's only worked with Undertaker a few times in the beginning. And those are the only ones I can remember. You guys, we're talking off 20-some-odd, almost 30-year memory now. But yeah. Those are the only two I really remember.
Now, what
Jerry
about
the thrown out? I can remember that was extra. Go ahead.
When DiBiase shoved the money down your throat or have down anybody's
throat?
Yeah,
that one. Yes. That was an extra payday too. Now that you mention that, yes.
Any other thoughts, Ryan?
My second question is: I know you used to wrestle with Mr. Wrestling 3. Did Mr. Wrestling 2 ever have any comments on that gimmick that you did?
The only thing I ever heard was one time Bill Apter told me he had just talked to. And two said, as long as everything was taken care of, he didn't have a problem with it. Because by that time he was retired, so I wasn't going to be cutting into anything he was trying to do. He was in Hawaii living with mama and living the good life. And the word he sent to me through Bill Apter was, as long as I took care of everything. And that was the only thing that was ever said to me.
Okay, thanks, Dusty.
Yeah, no problem.
There's Ryan dialing up at 646-721. 9828 646-721-9828. You can also tweet me at Jim Valley, or you can email at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. One of the things I remember from your time in WWF, this was during the scandals of the 90s, and this was a different TV era when Entertainment Tonight, the magazine show, was a big deal.
I learned right then and there that what a TV editor can do with a piece of tape, and to never, ever again do anything that could be taped if I didn't want it to be. Because they showed like 3 seconds of me saying, oh, no, I wasn't, and that was it,
let's
2 minutes. Go ahead.
Let's reset for everybody. So so basically, back then in the TV era, Entertainment Tonight was a very popular show. Mm-hmm. Usually came on, like, say, after your local news, when your local news was popular,
right.
And they were covering the steroid scandal and the drug scandals, and
Hartford, Connecticut, when they did this to me, I remember that.
Okay. So they had highlights of the taping and they had no interviews, but the one interview they had was with you, and obviously they must have caught you coming outside the arena.
Out of the building,
they
caught me. Yeah, go ahead.
And so
go ahead.
Yeah, I remember it too because I was wondering how much trouble you got in. But
but it wasn't. Go ahead.
The story was that they had drug tested everybody that night, and they interviewed you and the tape when you said go ahead and you can take it from here. But the 3 seconds of tape said that you didn't take a drug test.
Well, that wasn't a lie either. But what happens? I was walking out of the building with Horowitz and I can't remember who the other was, to be honest with you, but we were leaving the Hartford, Connecticut building, whatever arena that was. And whoever the third person was said, I have no comment. Barry Horowitz just cut a promo on him. And they put the microphone in my face, and I'm thinking I'm going to be a nice guy. And I'm sitting there saying, yes, they've been doing testing all night. Well, did they test you? They're going out to look at order last name Wolf. They haven't got to me yet, which was the truth. The next night in, I want to say.
Hey, Dusty, you're breaking up. Did you move locations?
Oh, yeah,
you're breaking up.
Yeah, I did. I poured a cup of coffee. Is that better?
Okay, that's better.
Yeah, can you hear me better now?
Yeah, no problem.
Were in Hartford. We were in Hartford. And like I said, the first person that walked out just refused to comment. Barry Horowitz just cut a typical promo on him, and they just took the microphone away from him. They put it in front of me, and I'm thinking, well, I'm going to help the company, right? So like, they've been testing all night, which they had been. They were also testing in alphabetical order best they could, and that's what I told them, including the fact that my name's Wolf, and I'm scheduled for tomorrow in Springfield, Mass., or wherever we were at the next day, Worcester, whatever town it was. And that was, you know, it was like about a two-minute interview going back and forth with that explanation that, yes, they're testing it and they're doing everybody down the list, and I just haven't got to me yet because of the fact that there's just so many. And then when you see it the next night or two nights later or whenever it was, all you see is 3 seconds of, no, I wasn't tested. That's it. And a few days later, a week later, I got told just, let that be a reminder. Don't ever do anything that we don't tell you we want you to do. And that was it. I mean, that was all that happened to me. So I was fortunate.
So that you didn't get in any trouble?
Nothing major. They made sure that they knew I knew, and they knew, they all knew, we all saw it. They made sure I knew that. But there was no, we're firing you over it, because they knew I was, they knew what had happened. Supposedly, Finkel demanded to see the whole interview before they made a comment on it. This is what I'm told. I don't know how true it is. And that was what saved me.
Well, you tried.
Yeah, exactly. You think you're doing it. I was too naive. I mean, I might have maybe been 30 at the time. You know, I probably wasn't even that old. And you don't realize that tape is all in the hands of the person with the scissors. Even if you're telling the truth completely, they can edit it out how they want it. Yeah.
So one of the reasons that I thought about having you on the show was because of JBL this past Monday.
Yeah.
On Raw dropped your name in your book, and it makes sense because you're a Texas guy and he's a Texas guy. You used to work with JBL back in the day, like in the Global and Texas days, right?
Global, we went to Japan together a couple times. Yeah, in fact, I was probably, I know Rod Price had JBL's first match ever. I had like his second or third, and then God knows how many times I had that stiff bastard. Oh, God. But, yeah, we were up and down the roads in Texas together. We were in Japan together twice.
That's what I was going to ask you about. When he was starting out, because he has a reputation for being fairly stiff. He's always been that way, huh?
Well, he was then. Of course, most of us were when we were green. I don't want to use the word art because that gets overused nowadays, but there is a certain ability that comes with they only see us, they don't feel us. And when you're young and you want to look good and you want to make a reputation and you want to keep a job, you tend not to learn that quickly, especially when you're 6'6" and 300 pounds or whatever he was at the time. You know, it just, yeah, he was snubbed then. I don't know what he's been in the last 10, 15 years, but dear Lord in heaven, when he started coming straight out of football, oh.
As far as I know, and you know, I'm not a wrestler, so I try to stay away from stuff like that. I know that's kind of unique, but that's what I understand the reputation. Now, were you surprised how far he went in wrestling?
Yes and no, if that makes sense. No, in the fact that he was perfect for Vince's machine. Perfect, you know, 6'6", 300. So he's just exactly what you need to on the national scale, the national level, international, actually. Yes,
yeah, you're breaking
from the
up
fact,
again, wherever you are.
Yeah, I know I haven't moved, so this one isn't me. So, I mean, is that better?
There we go. There's your sweet spot.
All right. There's my spot. Yeah, yes and no, because, like I say, he was perfect for the international scale for what Vince was doing. as far as being, you know, such so big and so rugged. But John was always into something, and he was always he liked to keep it stirred up, and Vince doesn't like that much. So that surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, he's had quite. Now, do you talk to him at all, or was that just kind of surprising?
No,
that mentioned?
I haven't. I didn't even know about it. All of a sudden, my phone's blowing up, and everybody's. Let me see. I got kids just walked in the door. I was. I don't expect anything out of that office, to be honest with you. So, when I heard about it, it was surprised the hell out of me.
You're breaking up a little bit more. We're talking with Dusty Wolf. Hey, we got another email here from Brian, who wants to know, for example, for you, being an handsome guy in WWF, how did you piece together a living? Which is all
well,
in
actually,
your book, by the way. But
yeah,
but
it is. It's all in the book. But the thing is I wasn't just the enhancement with WWF. I actually had house shows, so that helped with paydays, too. And then I just worked with whoever would hire me and had a reasonable ability to pay me. I stayed on top of it. That was one thing you have to do. And there were times where I worked with the remaining territory there was during the really slack times with WWE, F, whatever we want to call them.
Sure.
And it was just a matter of what you call today networking. I just had to stay on top of it.
So let's talk about some of the guys that you worked with during your enhancement time. Was there anybody who was very disrespectful to you in the ring?
Besides Dynamite, who I don't think he liked too many people. the Beverly Brothers actually had a bad attitude in those days. I don't know what they're like today, but they had a bad attitude. Beyond that, the average guy, the vast majority of them, knew that without somebody like me or Horowitz or Reno Riggins, guys like that, if they didn't have us, they weren't who they were. And they had a much more respect for us than you would imagine.
What about people that maybe you had to learn? Was there anybody you really had to prop up and make them look better than they were?
Well, there's quite a few of them. Yeah, it's hard to say you did it outside of just the way you sold for them, that sort of thing, in so many of those matches, because they were just so short. But, yeah, there was quite a few of them, especially when the guys that they were looking at to bring in and they were green and had never really had any place to work, you know, like a Tatanka. He really, you know, he may have turned into a good worker, but when they were looking at him, he'd had no place to really learn. And for lack of a better term, he had no place to develop. And so they're bringing him in, and they had ideas for him, but he couldn't put two and two together because he'd never been in the buildings where it had worked, and he'd seen it, and he's like, okay, well, I know how to do that sort of thing. And you just have to either make him sell or you have to sell for him. And that's what it comes down to with those guys. It comes down to selling, whether you're selling it for them or you're making them sell.
So it's funny I have you on the show because a couple of weeks ago I was on YouTube watching the old Florida stuff. And I didn't even realize that was you. Was it the Hollywood Blondes?
The Hollywood Blondes, yeah. Ken Timms had been here with Embry, and they had a falling out. And we went from here to Memphis for 2 or 3 months, and then we went from there to Florida for about 4 or 5. Yeah.
Yep. So let's talk about working. You didn't seem to be a big fan of working Memphis like a lot of guys are.
I love the territory. I couldn't stand the promoters. Lawler was still at the peak of his ego, running everything according to the Lawler, and Jarrett pretty much let him. And that was one of my biggest issues. I'm green. I didn't understand it at the time. All I knew is we were going around working hard, and we weren't getting anywhere quick. And I didn't realize that it was all revolved around Lawler and nothing else, and I didn't realize that Jarrett came from that Welch mentality that if you're not over within a week or two, I don't need you.
Well,
but as far as
you
the
know,
area, go ahead.
Well, I mean, and a lot of people feel that way. I mean, there's a lot of people who still hold resentment against Lawler and against Jarrett for, you know, not making a lot of money and, you know, there's definitely in Memphis the haves and the have-nots.
Yes. You know, and the money situation, I don't quite get it because I can't complain about our paydays. We were making as good or better than anywhere else in those days in 84. Yeah, 84. The bad Memphis paydays were either before Jarrett or just a few years later when he knew he just didn't have to pay anything because the guys were going to be begging to work. We were still making, you know, 6-7 a week in the middle of the card, which was not bad 30-plus years ago. Wasn't great money, but it was livable. So I don't have that complaint with them. It's just the attitudes that they have. It was very cliquish, very... Lawler had his little clique, Jarrett has his little clique, and if you didn't belong to one of them, life got real miserable real fast.
And I'm guessing you never filled in a clique. It was probably hard for guys who were coming in and out to find a place.
Yeah. Yeah, that, and then I was just never personality-wise one to fit into a clique anyway. All my friends were the outlaws like Brody and Murdoch and guys like that. That was, if they had a clique, it was their own little clique, you know. The guys that always gave me breaks for the Robleys and guys like that, they were outlaws. In my mind, that was the way you did it.
There's something I wanted to bring up with you talking about that. As we were watching, you know, every year WrestleMania, WWE does the Hall of Fame, and you know, the guys come up and they give speeches, and Stan Hansen gave a speech this past year talking about different stuff. And it occurs to me that we really are losing the outlaws. And for Hall of Fame speeches, we're going to go from, you know, 10-hour drives and all the women and all the rats and everything to, oh, yeah, I had a war on Twitter with this guy that eventually
right.
was the Hall of that we're really kind of losing that outlaw nature for better or for worse of wrestling.
Well, yeah, it's completely gone. You got to realize that when you still had the territories, the outlaws were pretty much the guys that made money because they already had the mentality. They knew how to take care of business, them first, the territory second. And in that case, if you knew how to book them, there was money to be made. Today, it's a corporate entity, and Vince isn't selling individuals. Vince is selling the WWE. And he has a three-ring circus going inside the WWE, and you're just as replaceable outside of one or two, three, four guys. You're just as replaceable as the next. And so you don't dare act out, because if you act out, how many of them are down there in developmental looking to take your spot? How many of them are considered on the main roster but just sitting in the back waiting for a chance? So you can't. And in the old days, acting out, sometimes promoters had sense enough to use that.
Speaking of outlaws, one of the guys you were good friends with was Dick Murdoch.
Yes.
And
youngest is... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I named my youngest after him. It was one of those things where I'm a little old to be having a youngest, but he came along, and he came along right at the same time Dickie died, you know, the same date Dickie died, so he's got Murdoch's middle name. Or has his middle name, he's got Murdoch. Yeah. That's what I should say. So, yeah, I named him after Dick.
One thing that your book mentions that I didn't know, people have always talked about Dick could have been NWA champion had he been more serious and things, but you mentioned specific times when he could have been champion.
That's when they were looking at him. If you go back in history, people say, oh, no, they weren't looking at it. Then why did Dick make a handful of shots in San Francisco, a handful of shots in L.A., why was he in all the NWA territories like in 73? And why was he in all the NWA territories like in 78, even though he was based in, say, Charlotte or Amarillo? Because they were shopping him. That's how they did it in those days. They would send you, and you would make a weekend for Shires. You'd make a weekend for Goulas. You'd make a weekend for Eddie, which was no problem for Dick anyway. But you get my point. You would be seen by all the promoters. And then the first round of votes was yes, no, whatever. And with Dick, both times, the first round of votes was no, he clowns around too much.
Do you know if Dick ever regretted it?
If he did, he never said it. He was just too big a independent type guy to have said anything like that. I'm sure he had to at a time or two. because the only time that he could have been making the same kind of money that Champ made was when he was over there working in Japan for Inoki on top. Otherwise, I'm sure he was making decent money, but he wasn't making what the Champ was making.
And so what kind of things do you think you learned from Dick Murdoch?
How to work. I had already figured out how to, when I say how to work, I mean how to work without killing yourself, how you can use the people against themselves, even in those days. Even by this time, you know, Dickie died in 96, so it was still beginning to change. But there's so many subtleties. I guess that's the right word, subtleties, of how to get stuff over. And him, Jake, there's a couple others that they were just masters at that. And those are the guys I learned that stuff from.
So you're a Texas guy. And
right.
One of the guys you do you knew well in Texas was was Lance Von Erich, who, you know, I'm a guy who grew up in the Seattle-Portland area, so I saw Lance when he was up here in Portland before he made it to Dallas.
Right.
He got some training up here as Ricky Vaughn, and I've always been fascinated with Lance Von Erich, Kevin Vaughn. What was he like? You worked a couple of shows in South Africa, even main evented a South African pay-per-view with him.
Yeah, did that. Lance was my go-to guy when I was booking overseas stuff. Whenever I could get him, I'd take him to Singapore and places like that, because he was, not only was he one of the nicest guys in the world to just talk to, dealing with him was just a pleasure. And he was so underrated as a worker by the time he left Dallas. When he first got there, I think even Lance would tell you he knew he was bad as far as working goes. But by the time he left there, he was working two and three times a night, carrying the Von Erich name, carrying WCCW. And by the time he left, I think he catches a bad rap. Really, he does. Lance is one of the true good guys.
You know, I don't know how he didn't think that it couldn't end badly with Fritz, with the whole Von Erich name.
You know, when we're young and somebody's giving us an opportunity and they're selling us on this idea, we don't think about the bad side or the negative side or the possible ending. We don't. We're so busy, especially in an era where the opportunities were getting fewer and fewer. And you know, hindsight, like we said, 2020, and I agree with you completely. How did he not know, knowing what we know in 2016, but in, you know, what is it, 86 or so? There's no way for him to know that. He's a young guy. He's trying to get a chance. The Von Erichs are still, hell, today, there's still people in Dallas that if you say anything bad about the Von Erichs, you may be ready to fight. So imagine what it was like just a couple of years after that big hot run. And it looked great on paper. It's like that drawing board saying it was great on the drawing board.
Why do you think he never went to, say, WCW or WWF, or tried to, you know, he just kind of did international stuff?
There's a part of Lance, I love him to death, but there's a part of Lance that has to keep moving. And in the 30 years I've known Lance, he's lived in India, he's lived in Israel, he's lived in South Africa, he's lived in Mexico, he's lived in about five different Caribbean islands. He's lived in Greece, and he just goes where the winds blow. And I don't think he would have been a good fit, but I don't think he would have lasted. I think he would have driven himself nuts being in that kind of structure. He's a free spirit. He's able to take care of himself and make a good living, so, you know, bless him, but that's just Lance.
Is he in South Africa now? Do you know where he is these days?
No, he's in Baja. And the last time I talked to him a couple of months ago, he was the people he works for were looking to move him to, I believe it was Las Vegas, which would be the first time he's been in the States in probably 15 years.
So let's talk about some of your international tours, like when you did. What was it like? How do you hook up with wrestling in South Africa, particularly during the apartheid era?
The first time, well, there was always wrestling there, but Jan Wilkins was the old timer that he kept it under control, kind of like Vince has everything under control here today. And when he retired, a couple of different people jumped up trying to promote, and I just got a phone call out of the blue, do you want to go? I believe it was like 88 the first time, and I'm like, sure, I don't care about politics. I need to feed my family. Let's go. And once I got there, there was another fellow by the name of Paul Lloyd that was working. He says, I'm going to start running a different part of South Africa. Will you work with me if I do this? I said, yeah, no problem. And in 90, he called me, and that's when I did the main event with Lance in Sun City. And then I went over like 6-7 more times with Paul, helping book that thing for him. So that's how that happened.
And talk about, so it was a, you worked, I guess your big show was a pay-per-view there. It was on national TV?
Yeah, my second trip. It was at Sun City. They did a live pay-per-view. They had just started a all-sports network, called it MNET in those days. I have no clue what it would be today. And put it together, and somehow or another, Paul trusted me to do the main with Lance. And we ended up actually having a really good crowd and a really good sell rate, comparatively speaking, you know, when you consider the number of houses that were hooked up and so on. We did really, really well. Sun City brought Paul back every year for the next 5-6 years. At least once, and gave him shows in all their resorts across South Africa. So it was a good thing.
Now, did you introduce, I mean, what were the wrestling fans like in South Africa? I mean, was this without, what kind of TV did you have? How did it work?
There was none. There was
wow,
no TV.
Really?
It was all press, yes. It was all newspaper, flyers. When I say there's no TV, there might be little clips on the news, that sort of thing. But that was it. When I first got there, TV went off the air like at 10:30 at night. It was also government controlled. By the 90s, you started having satellite and cable, or their version of satellite and cable. But yeah, when I first got there, broadcast TV was off the air like at 10:30 in the evening. And it was all regimented and all controlled and governed by the government. And there was no TV show. It was all, like I say, flyers and newspapers and that sort of thing.
Now, we should mention that this is the time with things where there's a lot of, well, there still is, but there was a lot of strife and a lot of issues with South
yes.
Africa dealing with apartheid. Talk about some of the things you saw then.
Well, my first time I went, apartheid was still in full force, where you would see the signs telling you blacks here, no blacks, whites only. You would see just blatant racism, violence among the races. It was pitiful. It was horrible. And that was my first time in 88. And then during the 90s, somehow or another, I ended up being there either right before or right after a lot of the pivotal situations that took place in the 90s, it changed South Africa, like Mandela being released and then Mandela being elected and that sort of thing. And you could see tension. I want to say it was tension, but there was, it's hard to say because there was times where it was nothing more than just a lot of talk. But then there were other times where violence did break loose. But when you realize that you went from that minority rule that was so oppressive to a majority rule almost overnight, and there was not any more violence than there was, it was actually pretty calm, so to speak. Maybe not if you were caught right up in the midst of some of it, but considering how easily that country could have gone up in flames and didn't, I think it's a testament to Mandela, and it's a testament to some of the folks that realized, you know, the gig is up, we just might as well go with it.
Some of the stories that I think are the craziest in your book are when you went to India.
That
and
place is crazy.
I guess
yeah.
I mean, just so it sounds like it was just so packed with people, and you know, not the cleanest place in spots, and it just it sounds like it was a pretty rough place. And I was surprised how sick you didn't get.
I drink. I mean, let's just be honest. Even if I didn't drink, I knew that a little bit of alcohol does help keep you from dying from dysentery. And some of the guys who didn't drink, they came close to death. Because, yeah, it's just one of the most unsanitary places I've ever been. I don't know what it's like today, but at that point in time, it was horrible. And there was no such thing as a middle class. You were either wealthy and were completely separated from the masses, or you were one of the masses that just lived in the, if you had a tin shack or something like that, you were doing good. It was horrible. I never seen anything like it.
Yeah, that's the thing that I don't understand about people trying to break into India. It doesn't seem like did you guys have sold shows, or did you have charge admission? How did you make money over there?
Well, yeah, you have admission. I mean, there's just so many people there that you can do decent business in India. Some of the largest houses the largest house I've ever been in front of was in India. But that's just so much population that comparatively speaking, there's very few places in the States that every night you're going to put 8,000-10,000 people in a building. That's not a lot when you got, say, 2 million in the city, but that's still better than anything that's going on here. We were in, I want to say it was Calcutta. We were in a cricket stadium, and there was something like 50 people in that place. I don't know how many of them were paid. I don't know how many of them busted through the gate and made sure they got in for free, but the place was only like half full. It was still 50,000 plus. But Calcutta is what, probably 10, 11 million people?
What kind of wrestling do they like in India? Is it brawling? Is it scientific? What do they like?
Yes. They like brawling. They have a little high spot here and there, but they want the brawling. They just want to see people beat each other up. Yeah.
So talk about, go ahead and tell us from your book or whatever, some stories, maybe a law enforcement story, whether it's Mexico or India or where have you.
Oh, Lord, there's been a few of them. I wasn't as wild as some of the boys, but I was always into something. In the book, I don't know that there's really that many in the book as far as law enforcement. Some of the worst law enforcement stories are actually here in the States, where I have a deputy sheriff handing me a blade to stab Bubba Monroe because Bubba Monroe's getting that kind of heat, and we're down in South Louisiana. Yeah, that sort of thing. I've been in South Louisiana and had the guns pulled on me because I still had my mask on and didn't remember to take it off as I'm driving down there, and that part's my fault. But still, you know, you're having to go through all that. Overseas, as far as law enforcement, I guess the worst when I actually received was in Mexico when I got arrested for chewing on a straw. That's all I was doing as I was walking back to my hotel, and I was arrested for possession and strip searched in the middle of the intersection.
Sounds like fun.
It was. Cost me $200 to get out of that car.
At least there were no smartphones and no one taking pictures back then.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the middle of the six lanes going one direction, the six lanes going the other, with the doors open to try to give me some privacy while they were strip searching me because I was chewing on a straw, picking my teeth with it.
Jeez.
But well, Mexico's only gotten worse since then. So I don't even go across the border on the border towns anymore.
Yeah, you're not. According to your book, you're not the biggest fan of Mexico and doing business in Mexico.
I wouldn't go back, even no matter what the business is. I won't. Now, we talk about corruption in other places and other countries, and yet 2 hours from where I live is one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And we just kind of turn a blind eye to it. But, yeah, it's horrible. And it's a third world country. It's not as bad as India and the Middle East, but it's not far behind either as far as just filth and living conditions and so forth.
So you're a Texas guy. You spent a lot of time in Texas. Let's talk about some of the guys you worked. Like Black Bart plays a big part in your book.
He loved Bart. You know, Bart's one of those guys, you love him or you hate him because he's just so loud and so outspoken. And he's one of those guys that if you don't want to know, don't ask him. I love that out of people, even if I don't like what they have to say. I love that. And Bart's one of those guys. And at the end of the day, Bart's got that heart of gold that you might have to dig for it, but it's there. And he'll probably kill me if everybody ever told him I said that. But, yeah, I love Bart. Bart's a hell of a guy.
One thing about your book that I liked is you call the truth the truth, because I never went there, but you can just tell from the pictures of the inside and the outside that the Sportatorium was a dump.
There's no other way to put it. The place, whenever the bell rang until the final bell rang, it was magic, even later after the big Von Erich run, because those fans just so enjoyed being there. But it was nothing more than just a barn that was heated in the summer, air conditioned in the winter. And I can promise you that the only reason that there was codes that had been signed off on that this building has passed electrical code, this building has passed water code, is because Fritz owned enough property in Dallas and paid enough taxes elsewhere that he was just getting these signatures to keep it open because of favors or bribes or both. It was horrible.
I look at that place and people go, oh, the legendary Sportatorium. I'm like, that place just looks terrible. Looks like with
it's
a
both.
Stiff wind, it would fall over. It would have fallen over.
That's what I mean when I say it was air conditioned in the winter. Even when they closed it up and tried to turn the heat on, it was still just as cold as could be. Yeah, it was both. It was legendary and it was a dump. Figure it was built in the 1940s, and the only time they ever improved it was when they had to.
It was garbage, all right. So I guess I got to ask you, because everybody from Texas, you got to ask their theory on the Von Erich family. Did you have many dealings with them?
Lance more than the actual family. Beyond that, Kerry. I dealt with Kerry more than the rest of them. David, I barely knew. Mike, I barely knew. Kevin, I don't know if anybody really knew Kevin. I'm sure there's a few folks, but not as many as you'd think. That whole situation was just guys that were allowed themselves to get out of control. And while he had a father that was strict in some ways, he was completely blind or lax in others.
So Kerry, people have always said that Kerry just sort of had this dumb jock charisma that made him likable. That you just, even though he was kind of a screw up, he was still kind of likable.
Yeah, you know, Kerry's one of those guys that how could you not like him once you got to talking to him, being around him? And that's exactly, dumb jock charisma. I mean, there's no other way to put it. He was just that big lug that you couldn't help but like.
So with your WWF stuff, who booked you?
Terry Garvin. I was coming home from working Hawaii, and I figured I might as well make a call. The worst they're going to tell me is no. Because in those days, you just called and you negotiated back and forth over the phone. If there was any paper signed, you signed it whenever you got to the building. That's when there was none of this developmental and all that other. And so I made the call from the LA airport. I was headed home. And Terry tells me, I can put you to work. I just don't know how much. And you won't be getting any kind of push. I can promise you that much. You'll just be looking at the lights. And I said, well, Terry, if you guys are paying what I hear you're paying, I don't care. And I started like 2 days later.
Now, did anybody else have the deal you had?
I'm sure they did. I never asked. I know other guys had nightly deals as far as showing up for the TV and then hotels and whatever. I know quite a few that did, but I don't know if they had as good a deal enough as far as nightly cash as I did or not. I always was told later that I had one of the better ones. So how true that is, I don't know.
Now, looking back, do you see that being on that platform as an enhancement guy, do you think that helped or hurt your career? Do you regret it at all?
Both. Do I regret it? Never. I can honestly look people in the eye and, I made it to the biggest office when they were at their hottest, even if I was underneath enhancement, whatever you want to call it. A lot of people can't say that. A lot of people haven't made it to the biggest office in the world even when it wasn't at its hottest. So, no, I don't regret it there. If I was to have a regret, it's I didn't try to play the game sooner as far as help me do something more with me, that sort of thing. I got content. I wasn't hurting for money as far as working for them goes, so I got content, and that was my problem. Beyond that, I really can't say the only thing that ever bothers me, and I realize that it's not necessarily a flaw with me, it's a flaw with others, is when people want to try to make themselves feel important or more special than me just because they can watch a 30-year-old tape and watch me do a 3-minute job. I'm like, okay, why? Or when people equate the fact that I spent 6 years with Vince doing jobs that I must not know the business, I must not have any intelligence. Yeah, that one bothers me a little bit. I'm like, okay, guys, I have a master's degree. I teach in college, so I may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I'm not the idiot you think I am. And two, if I made 29 years in the wrestling business, I had to understand something somewhere. Nobody can kiss that much ass. I don't care who they are.
We're talking with Dusty Wolf. If you want to dial in, you can now at 646-721-9828. Let's go to 718. 718, you're on the live cast. Who's this and where are you calling from?
Hey, how you doing? This is Mike from Brooklyn.
Mike, what do you got for Dusty Wolf?
Hey, how you doing, Dusty?
Good. How are you, Mike?
I'm pretty good. Yeah, of course, you know, I remember you, you know, from the mid-'80s to early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, you were pretty much one of the perennial, you know, underneath favorites. Like,
yeah,
even
at times
head,
I was on TV more than those guys. Yeah, top guys.
Yeah.
That's true.
Even in my head with my little figures, it would be, you know, a big name against Dusty Wolf or Dwayne Gill or something like that.
That's yeah. It. You had guys that were reliable. Exactly.
Right. Well, to actually, you know, just to add on with the, you know, the sportatorium question, you know, I saw you not too long ago, a couple weeks back on the ESPN Classics on the on what was it, Global Wrestling,
yeah,
on GWS.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Tell me, like, what was it like, you know, working there? Because at one point they were pegged to be like, you know, a big deal, and you know, I was a fan. Like, it spun out a lot of, you know, of the stars we know now. So. What was your time like this?
Global was, it hit at a bad time. Let's just put it that way. Global was a good effort. It had some really good talent. Like you mentioned, it spit out some really decent, some great guys over a period of time. Had Global not come along in the early 90s when the wrestling business was dying, Global probably would have done much more than it did. I mean, we can always look back and say things positively, but I honestly believe it would have because of that young talent. It was actually that good. I enjoyed it. It was close to home. And at that point in time, with the independent scene beginning to start, you had a lot of independents that would bring guys from the Global tape to their towns. And they used Global as in the old days when you had the actual territory tape. So it was great for me. I just wish it had a better owner. Let's just put it that way. Gray Pearson didn't really know what he was doing, but insisted on being involved, and that didn't help. But I think more than anything, just the time period doomed Global.
Okay. And my last question is, like, because you've been in pretty much with everybody, like, you know, are the biggest stars. Like, who was,
during that,
like,
time period, yeah.
Yeah. Who were, like, you know, some of the pleasures to work with, and who was just, like, you know, just some of the, you know, just not too, you know, idiots to work with?
Well, there weren't too many idiots as far as Vince went at that time. Those came along later after the wrestling school started spitting out guys, and I didn't come across too many of those. But as far as pleasures, I had a full office. You know, you had Martel, you had Tito, Kurt, Marty, Sean, Jake, Lord, Barry Horowitz, from all people. You know, I keep bringing his name up. Barry's probably the most underrated guy in the wrestling business ever that I've seen. God, there was, I'm sure there was a couple I'm missing. But there were a lot of talented guys in there during that time that were just so easy to work with. I'm drawing a blank on names now, but the guys that I just listed, those would definitely be at the top of the list.
Okay. Thanks, Dusty.
Yeah, no problem.
There's Mike dialing in at Brooklyn at 646-721-9828. You can tweet me at Jim Valley, or you can email at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. When you're working for the WWF like that, do they give you specific instructions on, I guess, basically to put it, how not to get over? Like, don't be too colorful, don't do things like that?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like it is today where every little step is, you're told every little step. But, yeah, like the last caller just mentioned, he saw me in Global. I may not have been the most talented guy, but you can see the difference in my work in Global than you can with Vince. Because you know your job is to get these guys over. And when you had somebody that was green or they were big, you had to work that way. And you had to, if you were supposed to be getting over, you would be given a match to get over. Your whole occupation was getting them over. So, yeah, you were told, don't do this, don't do that. We don't – not that often, but you were told.
Because, yeah, I mean, you would see guys who, like you'd see somebody maybe wrestle for for a smaller independent on TV like a South Atlantic, and you'd see that they would have more charisma than they were allowed to show on WWE TV.
Exactly.
So,
there's a reason for that. I've got money invested in these guys. Even if they'll never get over, I'm investing money in them trying to get them over. And my money's not invested in this guy or that guy. So there's perfectly good reasons for it from a business standpoint.
You also worked with a guy that has a long history, had a long history with the NWA, Steve Rickard.
Yes, yeah. That's another one of the few guys that I would swear to no matter what.
Tell me about Steve Rickard. You had a lot of nice things to say about him.
He was a great man. We just lost him here about a year ago or so. Steve was one of a handful of promoters that I worked for in all my years. And if he told me something, I knew that's what it was. I never had to wonder. I never had to doubt it. Even if somebody went behind him and tried to screw up whatever he was promising or doing, he would still find a way to make it right. He was one of a kind. Steve was, I can't say too much about Steve.
Now, were you on that tour when they switched the NWA World Title belt without getting anyone's permission?
No, I was in Kansas City at the time, and of course Harley, that was his home, and Flair was in and out, so I knew about it. But no, I wasn't on that trip. I didn't go over for Steve the first time until like I want to say the summer of 87 or 88.
Yeah, so you're years past that. Was,
yeah.
He stuck on. He held on to the NWA long after things had fallen apart. Did he ever express to you his disappointment and everything?
Oh yeah, constantly. He was diehard that NWA. He was diehard NWA. Well, the NWA helped make him a wealthy man. Steve was smart with his money, and he ran shows that were profitable. And the NWA and the champ and the coalition that existed, they helped make him a wealthy man, and he was diehard. He hated seeing what was going on.
That reminds me, another interesting aspect of your book is your opinion on Jim Crockett, you're not the biggest Crockett fan. I think a lot of fans who consider themselves diehard wrestling fans, you know, look at the Crockett years of the mid-80s with a lot of genuine, you know, love and respect, and Jim Crockett is part of wrestling, but you're not the biggest Crockett fan.
Well, none of that was Jim Crockett. Every bit of that was tremendous talent, a good booker, and a mom and a sister that knew how to run his business for him. Just plain blank, point blank. You can't knock the talent he had during those years. Dusty Rhodes did a great job of booking the first two or three years he was booking. He got stale after a little while, but those first two or three years when everybody talks about being so hot before him, George Scott did a great job as booking for, what, 6-8 years? Oh, he did a good job. Always had a great booker. His sister and his mother ran the business. And when he was running that Dallas office in the mid-90s, I'll just flat out tell you, he had to know less about wrestling than any man I had ever met at that level, period, in a statement.
Well, and I think a lot of people expected him to do great things out of that Dallas office, and it never really
so
took off.
So did I. Well, again, part of that was just the time period. Wrestling itself, as we knew it, was dying, if not already dead, by the early mid-90s. It was not coming back. You can't, we can bring back Frankenstein in the books and the movies, but it's not happening in real life. And so that was part of the problem. But, yes, you expected more out of it from a man than Jim Crockett. This guy, the Crockett Promotions have existed since the 30s, and so you buy into it, me included. I was one of them. But then when I saw how the man ran business and some of the ideas he had, I'm like, dear God in heaven, it becomes clear some of the stories I'd heard through the years about how Francis Crockett was the real brains behind that, and Mama Crockett had made sure that Francis stayed in the position she stayed in and that sort of thing.
Hey, what about Christine Jarrett?
I love that old broad. That old gal, and I call her that I don't call her that to be disrespectful. I call her that because that's what she was. Just, she was loud. She was straightforward. And had I not been a green kid, not understanding what she was doing, I probably would have gotten along with her much better. But I love her now, knowing what she did, what she pulled off, and everything she accomplished. She was great. She was something else, buddy. She was one of those that you could just imagine that if she couldn't whip you, she'd find somebody that could. And if that didn't work, she's going to find a way to shoot you. She was something else. She was good. She knew what Tennessee, Kentucky, what those people wanted. She gave it to them.
Did you ever work for Liam Ivey?
I was coming back from, I worked 3 or 4 times for in Hawaii. That was the trip I was coming back when I got hired by Vince. Yep.
Now, she has a reputation for being kind of a tough broad like Christine Jarrett. How would you compare the two?
I think Leah probably could take you in the times where Christine couldn't. I mean, it's just, you know, there's no way you're married to the high chief all those years and you're not tough. But I liked her, too. She was, Leah along great. I have no issues with her. I know about the payoffs, and I was a victim of them a couple times, too, but she always took good care of me.
Gotcha. We're talking with Dusty Wolf, who had a long career in professional wrestling. You probably know him from his time on WCW and WWF. Now, when you were enhancement talent with WWF, were you forbidden from doing Crockett's TV?
Pretty much. It was not completely forbidden, but the one time that I did it as a favor for Grizzly Smith when he was in that office, I noticed my bookings dipped off for a couple of months. And my phone wasn't ringing for a couple of months.
But then you eventually did go to WCW and you worked Nitro and stuff, didn't you?
Yeah, that was in the mid to late 90s. Yeah. I didn't necessarily want to, but I figured everybody else was getting money for doing nothing. Why couldn't I try to get a couple of dollars? And then I stayed part-time for 2-3 years.
What was it like being backstage there? Was it pretty chaotic?
Yeah, the inmates ran the asylum there. They really did. Even if you were listed as being the man in charge or you were the boss, there was nobody that was the boss.
So, I mean, with a guy like you who's done tours internationally and booked people internationally and stuff, and you've had to run things in India and South Africa and stuff, what was it like to see having that many resources, that much money, and then that much chaos?
You just have to wonder why. Why can it be like this in one place, but when you have potential in another place, you couldn't have those kind of resources? It's just, yeah, that's the biggest question is why? Where did I go wrong?
If you're like me, you've got a list of favorite websites and a list of favorite podcasts that you visit either every day or throughout the week, but there's probably not a lot of crossover between the two. However, with PW Torch Livecast, that's different. If you're a listener of this show, you should also be visiting our main website, pwtorch.com, loaded with updates covering news in more depth than you'll find anywhere else. Editorials you won't find anywhere else, live TV coverage and pay-per-view coverage that's unmatched, and so much more on a newly redesigned, optimized, lightning-fast website. That's pwtorch.com. Check it out every day and bookmark it. No matter what device you're using, whether it's a mobile phone, a tablet, a laptop, or a desktop, there's a version that fits your screen and customized for your device. Check it out, pwtorch.com, one of the top sources of pro wrestling insider news since 1987 and online as a website since 1999. Don't miss out. Don't just listen to the live cast. In between live cast listens or while you're listening to the live cast, check out the latest headlines and exclusive articles at pwtorch.com. If you're a fan of the PW Torch Livecast, you might want to consider a PW Torch VIP membership. When you do that, you get access to an exclusive RSS feed of not only ad-free, plug-free versions of every single PW Torch Livecast, but also over 50 other VIP exclusive podcasts per month, including the Every Single Day Wade Keller Hotline. I also host 3 other flagship VIP exclusive podcasts: The Midweek Fix with Todd Martin, The Weekend Bruce Mitchell Audio Show, each about 2 hours in length, and the post-pay-per-view roundtables with a 1-hour analysis of every WWE pay-per-view and some other ones too. Also, ad-free access to pwtorchvip.com, and that is mobile-friendly and PC and desktop-friendly, and also access to almost 3 decades of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter dating back to the late 1980s, over 1,400 back issues with my pay-per-view reports on every single pay-per-view match since the late 1980s with star ratings and match descriptions, roundtable reviews from the staff on every pay-per-view, cover stories on the biggest story every single week in pro wrestling, march through them as a VIP member 1 week at a time, read our exclusive Torch Talks with pro wrestling's biggest names, hard-hitting editorials, backstage tidbits you will not hear anywhere else, and much more. It's all available. Check out details at pwtorch.com/govip. That's pwtorch.com/govip. exclusive podcasts, exclusive new newsletters every week, ad-free access to our website, and access to 28-plus years of archives. It's all waiting for you if you go VIP. Find out more details, a checklist of all the benefits of being a VIP member, along with testimonials from current members and a sign-up form that's mobile-friendly. It takes about 90 seconds to sign up. Go check it out today, pwtorch.com/goVIP.
We're talking with Dusty Wolf. He's got a book you can find on Amazon. You can look under Dusty Wolf. What's the title of the book? It's
General of a Journeyman.
There it is, The Wrestling Journeyman. And it's a great book. It's a full book. You can read about Dick Murdoch and JBL and his time in Puerto Rico with Carlos Colon. And I mean, everybody from pretty much the territorial days is in there. He talks about Bruiser Brody, and I think your thoughts about working Puerto Rico again after the death of Bruiser Brody, I think they make perfect sense, knowing what kind of businessman Brody was.
Yeah, I a couple times I had opportunities to go in for a month or two, and I wouldn't right after it happened. I didn't have to because I had everything going with Vince real well. And '91, the scandals were starting to hit, my bookings were slacking, I needed work, and I had a standing offer to go to Puerto Rico. And in the beginning, I'm like, no, I can't because of what happened to Brody. And then I realized that if it was the other way around, no matter what Brody thought of me, he was going to still feed Jeffrey and take care of Barbara if he had to. So I did the same thing.
So is there anything we haven't covered, Dusty? We've covered a lot of your stuff. I mean, I think people will enjoy your book if you pick it up. And if people want to follow you on Twitter, is that primarily your wife on Twitter? Or do you ever do
She
it?
Takes care of that. I wouldn't know how to find Twitter if I'd tried. I'm not that tech savvy. She comes to me. It's not just her answering and thinking, oh, I'm going to tell him later what I answer. She does. So it is me through her. Does that make sense?
So you can find it at Rancho Wolf. At RANCHOWOLFE, Wolf with an E.
Yes.
But you can also find it. It's also, you can find the link. I retweeted you a bunch of times on Twitter, so
okay.
You can follow Dusty at Rancho Wolf. Hey, man, I appreciate your time today, Dusty. It's been
a
lot of fun.
Yeah, and we set up a little publishing situation for the guys that have stories, you know, whether it's shorter stories, they want to write their book. We've got a publishing company. You can find it at DustyWolf.com. And my wife handles that more than I do, but basically guys that, you know, they don't have a deal anywhere else, but they want to get their story out. They think it would be worthwhile. Contact us. We can figure something out for you.
Well, that's awesome. Well, look, man, I appreciate your time. If we can do anything for you in the future, let me know. And maybe if you, I don't know if you talked to anybody from the old school in the business these days, but if you enjoyed the interview, I'd love to talk to any of your compatriots if they'd like to come on.
All right. Sounds good. I don't talk to a lot of them very often, but yeah, I'll definitely pass the word along to a few that I do talk to.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
People can find your book on Amazon, and if it wasn't for JBL, we wouldn't have had a great show today, so thanks so much, man.
Yeah, we need to thank John. We sure do. All righty.
All right, man. Take care.
There's
Dusty Wolf calling up there, and what a great story, man. The guy's been all over the world. I mean, you figure all the time that he spent, you know, being an underneath guy for WWF and WCW, it's like, who knew he had such a career as far as going to India and South Africa and all over the world, Singapore, and, you know, make it a career off of television, which is what you can do back in those days. And I'm glad that he's not one of the wrestling tragedies, that he's actually was able to go to college and teach history these days. So good for him. Hey, coming up, we got a little bit more coming up on the live cast, so stick around. We got more things in the way.